to Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 17. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, others Jeremiah, are one of the prophets." But he said to them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah," or Simon, son of Jonah, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." We'll stop the reading there, although that does not finish the context. But I wanted to get before you there where the Apostle Peter made the good confession, the first time it's recorded that confession is made, and the blessing that he received from Jesus as the result. What do you think of the Christ? As Jesus asked the Jews in Matthew chapter 23, "Whose son is he?" Now that's an important question. In fact, there's no question that you could ever be asked that's a more important question than that. The popular position among the educated elite today is to say that Jesus was a good teacher. And of course, they like to very pick, you know, that's the usual word for picking what part you want some of his teaching and ignore others of his teaching. They like the Sermon on the Mount. That's one thing that people who are of the educated elite like. And by the way, the Sermon on the Mount is a wonderful message. That is a revelation of the nature of the kingdom of heaven. So it's good that they like that. But they don't like what Jesus had to say about hell. Jesus talked about hell more than any other speaker that's recorded in the New Testament. And the educated elite of this world don't like to hear about that. They don't like to even think of it. In fact, most people don't. There's only a small minority of people in the United States that even believe there is such a place as hell. And by the way, I'm a part of that small minority because the New Testament is very plain on that. But what the people of the world, and they're called agnostics. The word agnostic simply means one who has doubts. And they'll take the position that, well, there's just not enough information. There's not enough evidence given. And so we can't take a position one way or the other. And what they're trying to do is occupy the middle ground. And that's so very, very popular in our world today. In fact, it's not just popular among the so-called educated elite. All you have to do is turn to the religion page each Saturday in the Baxter Bulletin and read the article by that guy who was in the military anyway, and he is an agnostic. Now, he may not call himself that, but that's what he is. He loves to take the middle ground and not be against anything, but always positive. And never say anybody's wrong. You know, you have your position, I have my position. I'm okay, you're okay. That's the world today. I'm okay, you're okay, everybody's all right. They have real problems when there's an Al-Qaeda guy trying to blow us all up. But hey, if I'm okay, you're okay, why isn't he okay? If there's no such thing as absolute truth. You know, it depends on whose nose is getting bloodied, doesn't it? And so that's a position that's hard to maintain when somebody's trying to kill you. But that is the position of the world. The I'm okay, you're okay, middle ground, nothing is absolutely right, nothing is absolutely wrong, everything's beautiful in its own way. But that, of course, just a bunch of nonsense so far as the New Testament is concerned. Jesus, on the other hand, demands that we take a position one way or the other. We cannot just be middle of the ground with Jesus. We can't say, well, he's all right, I wouldn't have crucified him. Yes, you would have crucified him if you're not for him. If you're not with him, you are against him. In John chapter 12, verse 48, to begin with, you cannot separate. Now, John chapter 12, verse 48. Again, I'll make myself take the time for you to turn to this. John chapter 12, verse 48. Compare this to the popular teachers of world religions. Buddha said, it doesn't matter that he's reported to have said this, it doesn't matter if you remember me, remember my teaching, remember the truth. So see, Buddha didn't place any great emphasis on himself. Jesus did. And we might, well, Buddha was humble. Maybe he was. But Jesus, I believe, was the Son of God. He was certainly humble, but he had to call attention to himself because according to him and according to the New Testament, he is the one and only way to salvation. And there's no separating what Jesus taught from Jesus himself. You can't say, well, I accept some of his writings or I accept some of the things he said that's recorded by his disciples, but I don't believe he was the Son of God. He was not ready to accept that. In John chapter 12, verse 48, Jesus said, he who rejects me, now notice carefully, and does not receive my words. See, you can't separate what Jesus taught from Jesus himself. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I've spoken shall judge him on the last day. So according to Jesus, the words and the Christ cannot be separated, and you're going to be judged by his words on the last day. So you can cherry pick what you want to accept now. And the Lord will not force you to do otherwise, but on judgment day, you will be judged, according to Jesus, by the words which he spoke. See if you can separate what he taught from the man himself. Look at John chapter 14 now, please. John chapter 14, verse 6, where Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going, and so forth. And Jesus said, John 14, verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus didn't say, don't remember me, just remember the truth. He said, I am. He himself is the way to God. He is himself the truth. He is himself the life. There's no way to God except through Jesus Christ. Now that's what Jesus taught about himself. I'm going to look at some things today that Jesus claimed for himself. I want to return to our text because this is the heart of what Jesus claimed for himself. I could turn to other passages. By the way, you have a lengthy outline in your hand. Don't worry, I'm going to cover a very small portion of that lengthy outline. The rest of it you take with you. If you have time, you study it. But at any rate, I want to return to our text, Matthew chapter 16, which is the heart of what Jesus said about himself. I could turn to other passages, which by the way are not on this outline, of what his disciples said about him, which are even more plain and emphatic than what Jesus said about himself. But I want to just center on what Jesus himself said about himself. So back to Matthew 16, our text. When he came into Caesarea Philippi, beginning of verse 13, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Now, by the way, this is what Jesus characteristically called himself. About 80 different times it's recorded in the gospel accounts that Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. But he's going to claim to be more than just the Son of Man. Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they gave him what they had heard from other people. Some say that you're John the Baptist. Some Elijah, some Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say? And by the way, do you notice how Jesus made that personal? You notice how Jesus did not say, well, you can't just say what some other person says about me. I want to know what you say about me. And this is the point that Jesus makes to every one of us. Jesus doesn't want us to tell him what somebody else says about him. He wants to know, what do you say about me? Jesus said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter gave the correct answer. But you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, did Jesus... Oh, now, Simon, you're overplaying it there. That's I'm just another prophet. I mean, by the way, if you just say that Jesus is just another prophet of God, then you could be a Muslim because the Muslims believe that Jesus was a prophet from God. They just believe that he was the sixth prophet from God. Muhammad is the seventh and the last. But they accept that Jesus is a prophet from God. That's, by the way, how I can teach a Muslim that he ought to be a Christian, because if they accept that he's a prophet, then turn and see what he said about himself. And if you don't accept that, then you don't believe he's a prophet. But nonetheless, what did Jesus say about himself? Well, Simon Peter said, you are the Christ. Now, the word Christ simply means anointed one, It is the New Testament equivalent of the Old Testament Messiah, which is translated anointed in your English New Testament, or Old Testament, excuse me. But the Greek equivalent of that is the word that's here translated Christ, and it means anointed. But on the basis of those Old Testament passages, Jesus is saying, or Simon Peter is saying, and Jesus is accepting this, you are the promised Savior of the world. That's what the Messiah was. The promised Savior of the world. You are the Christ, the Son. Not a Son, the Son. And I want to pay attention to that. The Son of the living God. Now, did Jesus say, oh, don't, that's too much? No, he said, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. So this is the claim that Jesus made for himself. And what all I want to establish this morning is you cannot take a middle ground with Jesus. Either you accept that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and on that basis that you believe everything that he teaches and obey everything that he commands. That's one, and you can call that an extreme position if you want to, but that's one possibility. Or you're against him. You have rejected him. Because that's the claim that he makes for himself. And everything that he taught is just around, is around, but not the center of what he taught. Everything else that he taught, the center is, he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And our salvation is based on believing that and obeying what he teaches us to do. And we cannot come to God in any other way. And that's the reason that Jesus said in Luke chapter 11, verse 23. That's Luke chapter 11, verse 23. He who is not with me is against me. And he who does not gather scatters abroad. No middle ground with Jesus. Either he's the Christ, the Son of the living God, or he is an imposter, a blasphemer, a fake, a liar, an evil man. You cannot say he's just a good man and a good teacher. It's one or the other. Either one extreme or the other. Either believe him and obey him, or reject him as an evil man. I want to see that Jesus claimed to be equal with God. Turn over to John chapter 5, please. John chapter 5. We're going to look there at verses 17 and 18. In this context, Jesus had healed a man who had been lame for about 40 years. He had done this on the Sabbath at the pool of Bethesda. And he told the man to take up this bed and walk. The Pharisees, with their usual, you can't do that, it's the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath forbid customary work. They didn't forbid something like this. Jesus didn't actually violate the Sabbath. He violated their traditions of the Sabbath. But notice the result when they said, you're violating the Sabbath. Look at John 5, 17 and 18. But Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Now, they knew what he meant by his Father. He's claiming that he's the Son of God. Does God cease his providential work because it's the Sabbath? Or did he, under the Old Testament law, cease his providential work because of the Sabbath? No. God goes on sustaining the universe, answering prayer, doing his providential work, even under the Jewish Sabbath, didn't he? And so they knew exactly what he was talking about. That's what he's talking about, and they understood that. The Jews did not misunderstand Jesus. And so he says, or they say in verse 18, and by the way, this was his their customary way, therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him. It seems like the Jews, their customary way of reacting to Jesus' claim was, we're going to kill this man, but they eventually did that. Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, now that is, he broke their traditions about the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. You know, I have three sons. those three sons are my equal in their nature. They may not be my equal in their authority. I'm still their father over them, although they're not under my roof anymore. But in nature, we are equal. And in the sense that Jesus was talking about, and the Jews understood that, when he said that God was his father, he is claiming deity. He's claiming divine nature. Now, by the way, the Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that Jesus is divine, is God, in the sense that being equal with the Father. They would use the small g. He's a God. That's what they do in their so-called New World Translation, which is a gross mistranslation. They claim he's the archangel from Michael from the Old Testament, and that he is a God, small g. So actually they're teaching paganism there. But nonetheless, when I show them John 5, 17 and 18, they say, well, the Jews said that he was making himself equal with God. Now reread verse 18. Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. John doesn't say the Jews say that. John is saying that. The inspired writer John is saying that Jesus was making himself equal with God. The Jews did not misunderstand him. And at this point, they're not misrepresenting him. They understood. He's claiming equality with God. They thought it was blasphemy. They were going to kill him. Jesus claimed that he was equal with the Father. In fact, Jesus referred to God as his Father over 100 times in the gospel accounts, but never in the same sense that we can say God is our Father. A striking example of this is in John chapter 20. This is Jesus appearing to Mary immediately after he'd been raised from the dead. Mary was the first one to see him after he'd been raised from the dead. And she at first did not recognize him until he called her name. And have you ever seen somebody out of context? And you, I know that person, who is it? But it's out of context, in a different place. And of course, not expecting to see them. Mary did not expect to see Jesus. She was just absolutely stunned by the fact that it was Jesus, because she thought he was still dead. She didn't understand he'd been raised from the dead. But she's the first one to see him raised from the dead. And she thought he was the gardener. And so she was asking, where have you laid him? And Jesus simply called her name, Mary. And then she that's the Lord. That's my Lord. And she fell at his feet and clung to him. And notice Jesus' response in John chapter 20, verse 17. Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren. Now he acknowledges that his disciples are his brethren, because he was and is a man. But he's also God. He's the only person, both God and man. But go to my Father, or go to my brethren, and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father. Did he say our Father? No, he said my Father, because God is his Father in an entirely different sense than he's our Father. Go to my brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and to your Father, and to my God and to your God. He's not the Son of God in the same sense that we are children of God. In fact, Paul talks about us being adopted as children of God. Jesus is the only begotten, the one and only, the unique Son of God. So he is the Son of God in a sense that no other person is. He has unique, unshared sonship. Turn over to Matthew chapter 11, please. Look there at verses 27 through 30. And this, of course, is the great invitation that Jesus issued for all mankind to come to him and to be saved. But what I want us to see primarily is the basis upon which he issues this invitation for all to come to him and to be saved. Matthew 11, beginning in verse 27. All things have been delivered to me by my Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son. He claims to have a unique knowledge of God, because, of course, he'd been with God through eternity. and no one knows the Son except the Father, or no one knows the Father except the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son wills to reveal him. I can't know God except as Jesus reveals God to me. He perfectly revealed God to us. It is God's moral nature in the life that Jesus lived without sin. God's will in the revelation that Jesus gives of his will. And his power in the miracles that Jesus worked. Jesus perfectly reveals the Father to us. Now on that basis he says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. You shall find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. That beautiful, beautiful invitation that we love, but it's based upon the fact that Jesus claims in a unique sense to be the Son of God, in the sense that no other person is, having the same nature as the Father himself. I'm going to go back to the gospel accounts and notice some claims that Jesus made about himself that cannot be explained away. You can either accept them or reject them, but you cannot explain them away that he was claiming to be something less than God. Turn over to John chapter 8, please. In John chapter 8, Jesus had, that's where the Jews came to him with a woman taken in adultery. And they were going to try him as to whether he would condemn her or not. And of course, they wound up condemning themselves. And they slunk away one by one because they could not face the challenge that Jesus made there. And then there's an exchange that takes place, as John records in John chapter 8, between Jewish leaders and Jesus, in which they're claiming that, well, you're just making this claim for yourself. You can't prove the claim. And Jesus tried to get them to come to grips with the evidence that he's given for the fact that he is the Son of God, and they're refusing to come to grips with the evidence. Now, with that in mind, as far as the context, look at verses 56 through 59 of John chapter 8. Your father, Abraham, rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Now, I want you to think about it. What if I were to say to you, well, your great, 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 great grandfather rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad? You say, you're insane. You're crazy. Or you might say what the Jews said to Jesus. Then the Jews said to him, you're not yet 50 years old. Well, you couldn't say that to me. You're not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham? Now notice Jesus' reply. Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, now that's past tense. Did he say, I was? Before Abraham was, I am. Does that make sense to you? How could Jesus be I am before Abraham was? Well, the Jews knew exactly what he was talking about, because once again, their response is they're going to stone him. They understood exactly what he was saying, because they knew what Moses said in Exodus chapter 3. When the Lord appeared to Moses in the wilderness at the burning bush and commissioned Moses to go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And Moses asked, if I go, who shall I say sent me? And the Lord, speaking from the flame of the burning bush in the wilderness, said, tell them, I am has sent you to him. I am that I am, the eternally self-existent one. There's no past tense with God. He's above time. He created time. He is from eternity to eternity, the eternal I am, the eternal present tense. And when Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am, he's quoting Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. He is claiming to be the Jehovah God who spoke to Moses from the burning bush. Now he's either the Christ, the Son of God, or he's an arrogant blasphemer, a fake, a liar. You cannot say he's just a good man. You've got to take a stand. one way or the other. Turn over to John chapter 10. Look at verses 30 through 33. There's several of the great teaching of Jesus recorded in John chapter 10. But look at verses 30 through 33. I and my Father are one. Then the usual reaction to the Jews. They knew what he's talking about. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered to them, many good works I've shown you from my Father. For which of these do you stone me? Jesus, they answered him saying, the Jews answered him saying, for a good work we do not stone you. By the way, they realized he worked miracles, but they just wouldn't come to grips with how did he work those miracles. For good works we do not stone you, but for blasphemy. And by the way, listen to me. By the way, if Jesus is not right, if he's not the one with the Father, if it is perfectly united with him in nature and in purpose, if he's not one with the Father, if he's not deity, if he's not God, then they were right to take up stones to stone him, because he was guilty of blasphemy. Anybody that claims to be equal with God who is not God is a blasphemer. And thus they said, we do not stone you for good works, but for blasphemy, because you being a man, make yourself God. Well, he was a man, that's true. He was before them in human flesh, but he was also God, and they could not come to grips with that. And then what Jesus said to Thomas in John chapter 14, this is where Thomas could not comprehend. Jesus was going away, and they couldn't go at this time where he was going. And Thomas said, well, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus said, I am the way. Thomas was just not comprehending what Jesus was saying. And so Jesus says in John 14, beginning of verse 7, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. Now, by the way, there's another passage in John chapter 14, verse 26, that shows us that Jesus is not saying he's the same person as the Father. That's not the point. He's saying he is so perfectly united to his Father with the same nature, the same purpose, the same will, and that everything he does is the will of the Father. He's talking about perfect unity with his Father and the same nature. That is how he and his Father are one. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it's sufficient for us. Now, how can I show somebody God? Literally, I cannot do that. God's invisible. Nobody can see God and live. No person seeing God in his form as God at any time. It's impossible to see that which is invisible. Literally, that cannot be done. But Thomas was missing the point that Jesus is making. Verse 9. Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long? And this is Philip. Yet you have not known me, Philip. He who has seen me has seen the Father. He has the same nature, the same will, the same purpose, perfectly united with the Father. So how can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I'm in the Father and the Father? You know, none of us can say that. I'm in the Father and the Father in me. The words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority. That shows they have the same will. And he only spoke those words he received from the Father. But the Father who dwells in me does the works. Well, I could go on and on. And you have in your possession, hopefully, if not, there's some on the table at the back, an outline that goes through the claims that Jesus made for himself. And I want to make notice of this before we draw this to a close. In this lesson and in the outline I've given to you, I've only noted the passage that shows the claims that Jesus made for himself. I have not noted the passages that were simply the record of what the apostles and prophets of the first century said about Jesus. They claim, and this claim is made repeatedly, he's the only begotten Son of God. Look at John chapter 1, verses 14 and 18, the first times in the New Testament. This is not in your outline. You can note this if you want to. This is the center of the claim that the writers make concerning Jesus. John chapter 1, verses 14 and 18. He's the only begotten Son of God. That word, that phrase, only begotten, means the completely unique, no other like him, the one of a kind, the one and only. God has many children. Every person who's a Christian is, in a sense, a child of God. But Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. He is completely unique. He is the only one who has completely one with the Father, and that they have the same nature, the same purpose, the same will. Yes, He was, and He is yet, a man. But He is also completely and fully God. That's what the New Testament plainly teaches. That's what Jesus plainly claimed for Himself. And you must come to grips with that. Either that's what He is, or don't accept anything that He said. Just turn against Him and be completely against Him. Because He's either the Christ, the Son of the living God, or He's a liar, a blasphemer, a false person in every sense of the word. Well, I believe with all of my heart that Peter made the correct confession. In Matthew chapter 16, when it said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." I haven't proven that today. All I've tried to do is get you to come to grips with the claims that He made. In the future, I want to talk about some evidence that we have in the Bible itself. Not to accept it simply because the Bible says it, but accept it because the evidence is overwhelming that He is what He claimed to be. He is indeed the Christ, the Son of the living God. And if that is the case, then He's the only way we can know God. He's the only way we can come to God. He's the only way we can receive salvation from sin. He's the only way we can spend eternity with God in the after a while. That's what people must come to grips with. The claims that Jesus made and the evidence for those claims. Well, just a moment, we'll stand and sing number 276. Number 276.